I want to continue a little bit here with, do a little bit more Plotinus. So I want to emphasize again with Plotinus. Plotinus believes that the world is real, that it's a good place. Actually, he, in many of his writings, he takes some effort to combat the Gnostics, who was another, that's a whole other thing, the Gnostics. But the Gnostics believed that the material world was inherently evil, that the demiurge that created it was a demon, and the whole world was evil. So he didn't say that. So, yet at the same time, there's this effort of world renunciation that has to go on. And but anyway, his explicit philosophy, you know, is there's the one up there, and everything flows somehow or other. The intelligence, what does he call it? Dares succession, and it succeeds out. And then there's the world soul and the souls and the world, and everything flows out, and it's all real. And it comes out by virtue of emanation or transformation. On page 84, he has an argument. All these entities at the beginning of 9, section 9, all these entities emanate from the One without any lessening of it, for it is not a material mass. If it were, the eminence, that is the things that come out, would be perishable. But they are eternal because their originating principle always stays the same. Not fragmenting itself and producing them, it remains entire. So they persist as well, just as light persists as long as the sun shines. So he has the same argument that we use, that he's so complete that even though everything emanates from him, he remains complete.
I thought that you indicated yesterday, at least from the view of...
Okay, I'll get into that, okay? Okay, now because... Now, so that's his explicit system. Now, what I wanted to talk about yesterday is if you start looking at it a little deeper, he says things that seem to contradict this. And I pointed out when he says that the word cause doesn't properly apply to the One. You can see that at the top of page 78 or 77 and 78. Let no one object that something contingent is attributable to the One when we call it first cause. It is to ourselves that we are thereby attributing contingency, because it is we who are receiving something from the One, while the One remains self-enclosed. In other words, we can say we are caused by the One, but we can't say the One causes us. Doesn't make sense, does it? But that's what he's trying to say. As soon as the One, you say it causes something, then it enters into relative existence with its projects. So what he has to do is he pulls this little trick, is that when we say One, we're talking about ourselves. We are caused by the One. But from the point of view of the One, you can't really properly say it causes. He says it remains self-enclosed. That's his statement, not mine. Self-enclosed, you know, locked in himself. And let's see, if again we look at page 87, There's a description of the one there. Talking about seeing the one. Actually, we should not say he will see. What he sees is not seeing, not distinguished, not represented as a thing apart. The man who obtains the vision becomes, as it were, another being. He ceases to be himself, retains nothing of himself. Absorbed in the beyond, he is one with it, like a center, coincident with another center. When the centers coincide, they are one. They become two only when they separate. It is in this sense, that is to say, when they're separate, that we can speak of the one as something separate. So only from the point of view of separation from the one can you... But in its own nature, it's one alone without a second. He says a little later on, the divine is not expressible. The vision of the divine did not imply duality. The man who saw was identical with what he saw. Hence he did not see it, but rather was one with it. And then this ends with this great famous passage in the experience is hardly a vision. It is seeing of a quite different kind, a self-transcendence, a simplification, and so on. And he says, a little later on, you go up, he says, the one that is above all things. It is not the soul's nature to attain to utter nothingness. Middle of 88. So when he goes upward, he arrives at something, not at something different, but at itself. Thus, when it is not in anything else, it is nothing but itself. Yet when it is in itself alone and not in being, it is in the Supreme. And then he says you should write, when you fall from this vision, this union with the One, you will, by arousing the virtue that is within yourself and by remembering the perfection that you possessed, regain your likeness and through virtue rise to the intelligence and through wisdom to the One. Go back up again. He talks about falling down and going back, falling down and going back. Such is the life of the divinity and of divine and blessed men, detachment from all things here below, scorn of all earthly pleasures, the flight of the lone to the alone. That's the famous, the flight of the alone to the alone. So this is like a big classic of mystical literature. People who are Mayavadis can go back to it over and over again and get additional strength and conviction from it. Yeah. Again. So that, yeah, the standard, you should understand, like, it's one thing I want to do by giving us a survey of this literature, as you can see how much agreement there is among all these people in all different times and places. And that agreement from the Mayavadis is one of their big strengths. All these people, starting from different cultures, different places, they've all bumped into the same thing.
Same sentence, but the rest of the sentence. The divine is not expressible, so the initiate is forbidden to speak of it to anyone who has not been fortunate enough to have beheld it in himself. So again, where does he write about it?
He didn't actually want to write. We have to say this for Plotinus. He wanted to keep his mouth shut, but finally he was persuaded at the very end of his days to write these things down. You know, he was very reluctant to, actually. But they ultimately, everybody wants to publish, you know. I don't know. It's not known. Now everybody reads it, you know. Anyway, the point I want to make is you can see that when he's talking about the one, say, from the point of view of the one, or in Shankaracharya's term, paramarthic, the paramartha view, you know, there's really no world that you see from there. You yourself don't exist. There's no seeing. It's just, you know, ineffable, undifferentiated union. Only from the vyavakara point of view, from the practical point of view, can we talk about this ladder going up to the one, this spiral, you know, rising upwards and coming to the one. So I'm saying that, and especially when you come down to the category of causality, whether you can say the one causes anything, you can't really. He himself, you know, tries to weasel around it. That you can make a good case that Shankaracharya was just being more consistent and thorough. And that Plotinus is just somewhat less capable, a philosopher. And that if he were a little more capable and he thought the position through, he would have to come to Shankaracharya's position. That this view of the one emanating everything would have to be Maya, and the reality is just the one and one alone and nothing besides itself. But you notice when Shankara at least speaks of the one emanating everything, at least that's a one now with qualities and things like that. He wouldn't accept this notion of causality that, you know, that you give what you don't have.
Who's that?
Shankaracharya wouldn't. He always says that the effects have to be in the cause, otherwise how could the cause give the effects?
Because when he's talking about Saguna...
No, anyway, just a general philosophical principle. The cause has to be in the effects.
Is this the logic that if you say the one is the cause of things,
yeah,
then it
loses, obviously. Then you see there's the one, there's the intelligence, one, two, three, there's the word, so it's number one. But he definitely says this one is not a numerical one. Remember, Plotinus has a little thing about how to understand one, and you can't understand it as one as opposed to two or three or four. It's not that kind of...
And it's not the totality...
Yeah, it's not the totality of all things either. Right. So as soon as you talk of it in contradistinction to the things that emanate from it, you've immediately lost the real idea. Now you're talking about some, you know, now you're your pointing finger you're looking at rather than the thing itself at the most. So that's clear now, what you have. But anyway, the point is about Plotinus, is this is what most people have in mind, impersonalist. Something like this, there's an impersonal one that emanates the universe. But that's not actually what Shankaracharya says. As soon as you talk about emanation, then you have qualities. Although he conceives of all qualities as material qualities. Is that clear? I'll make sure everybody understands this. Yeah?
Wait a second. So the Saguna Brahman, that would have the qualities that appear in the emanation?
Yeah, yeah.
And what is that Saguna Brahman?
According to Shankaracharya, it's like the universal form. That's the highest personal form of God. According to us, it's Krishna with inconceivable transcendental qualities. Right.
So then when you use the phrase one without a second means there's nothing else.
That's the way they understand it. There's this phrase, one without a second. They see the Lord as one without a second, diverse and many. They worship Him as one without a second. That's in the Bhagavad Gita. One without a second is used in all kinds of literatures to describe the absolute truth. Now, there's two ways to understand it. We understand one without a second to mean in a class by himself. In other words, God is one. It means no other is God. Krishna has no one equal to Him. So that way he's one without a second. And the other one is, one without a second means absolute. That is to say, that besides which there is no other. Now there's a sense in which Krishna is that too. We have it both ways. That is to say, there's nothing but Krishna and Krishna's energies. Since Krishna includes his energies, ultimately there's nothing but Sri Krishna. This is a Chinsha Beda Beda Tattva. There's two koans I use to at least, not to understand the Chinsha Beda Beda Tattva, but to hold it in my head. They come from Prabhupada's writing. You know, like the Zen people, they meditate on a little koan, you know. So here's, nothing is different from Krishna, but Krishna is different from everything. That's in Prabhupada's conclusion to the Bhagavad Gita in the last purport. I've simplified it a bit, but that's what he says. Nothing is different from Krishna, but Krishna is different from everything. And another one from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada says, there is nothing but Sri Krishna. There is nothing but Sri Krishna. Yet nothing is Sri Krishna save and except his own primeval personality. There is nothing but Sri Krishna. Yet nothing is Sri Krishna save and except his own primeval personality. Now these are Prabhupada's words. I've squished them up a little bit, but edited them slightly, but it's very good to I remember those two, and then when I ever have to explain to anybody what is a Chinsha Beda Beda Tattva, I lay one of those on the table and then try to explain it. There's nothing but Sri Krishna. So that's why I say, yeah, Krishna's one without a second. There's nothing but Krishna. But the whole truth is, yet nothing is Krishna save and except his own primeval personality. So that's what's meant by one without a second.
The Mayavadis, they mean
there's nothing. There's nothing. It's not really real. But you see, in Shankaracharya, you recall that the world had a kind of quasi, semi, not there but not there either existence. Really, it can't be there. But if it's not there, what are we talking about? And so he distinguishes these two modes of discussion. One is paramartha, which is when you're really talking about the truth, and then the vyavahara, practical distinction between things. You know. Yeah, Lola?
You're speaking about causality. Are you speaking about one idea of cause, or does that include all the different angles? A few times you said, you know, like my philosophy hinges on causality. Plotinus and Shankara have different ideas on causality.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of times, the analysis of causality plays a big part in all these philosophies, because the sense in which you talk about how is God related to the world comes down to a question of causality. So sometimes your more general philosophical ideas of what a cause is comes into play. An interesting thing that happens, you know, when you start dealing with theologians and philosophers is oftentimes big ultimate truths seem to hinge upon this solution of very technical, minute problems. I know this can't be the case, but it does happen at times. At times when you start falling a problem out and then you say, well, it depends upon the notion of causality, and then you get into all these discussions about causality, and maybe your ideas of causality, when you analyze them, they depend upon certain logical notions. And so the solution of some technical problem in symbolic logic, everything rests. It can't really be that way, but that's what always happens among these professional people like that. But so they do have different ideas of causality. That's a fact. Shankaracharya, it doesn't mean that all Mayavadis have the same idea of causality. What I'm saying is, you know, here Plotinus wants to say there's something impersonal without distinction, name, and form that emanates the universe. Shankaracharya wouldn't accept that. Shankaracharya wouldn't accept that. And I suspect he would criticize Plotinus just in the same way that I have. Really, if you look at it, you can't say that this one causes anything, and that you would need a doctrine of vivartavada, or illusion. Any other questions about Plotinus? Yeah.
Can I repeat that again? He cannot say that one cannot cause anything?
He cannot say, Plotinus, Shankara would say that Plotinus cannot claim that this one can be the cause of anything, because you can't attribute to it the relationship of cause. Once you've attributed a relationship to it, to other things, then you've made it relative.
Isn't that what he says?
Who? Yeah, he does in that one little place. But he doesn't seem to realize that that contradicts the whole philosophy. So there's a contradiction in Plotinus. He's not always consistent. And if you force him to solve the contradiction, then he'll have to come to some other position. Yeah, right. With Shankaracharya, here we saw that his solution, that somehow or other it's an illusion, Brahman isn't the cause of the world. That's what he really says. Nirvishesha Brahman is not the cause of the world. Then there has to be something called illusion, which seems to cover Brahman. So he's got a problem too. Somehow or other, see, you can't fit an impersonal God and a world together. They just don't work. Plotinus is trying, Shankara is trying, they're trying different ways to do it. But it doesn't work. So they end up denying, Shankara just really trying to deny the existence of the world altogether. And then, well, why does the illusion arise that there is a world? Okay, the world doesn't exist, but you have to admit there's the illusion of a world. Because we're sitting here talking, you know. Right now we're in the middle of this illusion. Well, that's because of ignorance. Whose illusion is it? Well, this is a question that does not lead to edification, you know. Forget it, you know. Yeah? I want to make sure we understand Plotinus as best we can, you know.
When you were introducing Plotinus, you do the one and the board before we came to the reading 2 days before. You mentioned that these seven levels were called levels basis.
Uh huh. Okay. One who has not yet arrived there, that is at the one, and notes the sanctuary is invisible, is the source and principle of everything, will also know that by hypostasis, hypostasis is seen. And that like alone joins like. So that is to say, you know, I think what he's saying here is that, first of all, before you move up, you have to move up to the platform of intelligence. And it's from the platform of intelligence that you gradually become more and more coalesced or condensed or unified and rise up to the one. In other words, there's a kind of a natural... The image that's often used in mystical literature, by the way, is the image of a spiral, you know? So you kind of, you know, and I use this diagram here, you know? So the hypothesis, and he talks about the ideas as forming a circle. In fact, everything is a circle that dances around the one, you know? He also uses that very famous image of the conductor of an orchestra. Some people are watching the conductor and they're in tune, but other people are not watching and they're... Anyway, so you go up this spiral and you come to the one. You become more and more condensed. So the one is seen. The jumping off point is this experience of the level of what he calls intelligence, the realm of the ideas. He's obviously talking about his own experiences. And it's something that he says is there, which is a higher realm, we would say a spiritual realm, but is not yet the realm of the one. In Christian mysticism, all this becomes identified with ranks and hierarchies of angels. And in Eckhart, you know, there's the Trinity and then there's the unity that's behind it, which is the Godhead as opposed to God. Higher than God is the Godhead. Well, the one, from the point of view of the one, if You can't say that it causes anything, because then it becomes relative. Only when you're down here can you see a relation of causality. But when you're up there in the One, then there's no such relation coming from the One. It takes getting used to, I suppose. So this is a general picture. Yeah, I wanted to go on, huh?
What is the, you said Vyavahara and Vyavakara.
Vyavahara. This is a, did we, why don't we, that's practical. That's Shankaracharya's term for ordinary reality, ordinary discourse, as distinguished from Paramartha. We've been through this. I think I had the word on the board a couple of times. And when we go to Dionysius, the Areopagite, this is a Christian application of Plotinus. Now, Dionysius, the Areopagite, had an enormous influence on Christian thought. Because, you see, what happened in the Acts of the Apostles, there's a description that when Saint Paul was preaching in Athens, there was a place called the Hill of Mars, Areopaga. And St. Paul went to this hill, and there were temples on this hill to all the different gods, Apollo and whoever was there. And it was also full of Greek philosophers who spent all day long just wrangling with each other and gossiping and everything. And so St. Paul went there to preach Christianity, and he found there one temple that was the temple to the unknown God. They were afraid they may have missed somebody. So they put in, and he said, I've come to teach you about this unknown God. And he began to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. So it's there, according to the Acts of the Apostles, one man converted and followed him, who was Dionysius. Dionysius the Areopagite. So this work, the works of mystical theology, showed up in the church under the name Dionysius the Areopagite, and they were accepted as the works of the disciple of St. Paul. So they had immense influence over Christian thought. In the 17th century, however, there began to arise critical scholars who looked at this stuff and says, look, all these ideas come from Plotinus, and they're late Neoplatonistic, and they couldn't possibly, there's no evidence of any ideas like this existing before Plotinus, and they analyzed the kind of Greek language he was using and so on, and on. In eternal evidence, these scholars showed that this was probably written around the 5th century, probably in Syria. And that the person, for whatever reason, had put the name Dionysius the Areopagite on it. Either because he thought he was being inspired by him, or he was dictating to him, or just to give the work more prestige, or whatever. And gradually everyone accepts now, the church, everybody accepts that these are a late 5th century product. Yeah, wrote under the name. So that he's often called Pseudo-Dionysius or Dionysius the Pseudo-Areopagite, you know. Because it was a big thing in the 17th century when it was disclosed, you know, when it was disclosed that this wasn't the pupil. Because so much, I mean, he's quoted like in Thomas Aquinas, everywhere. Everybody quotes him as one of the big authorities on the basis of his being the immediate disciple of St. Paul.
Yeah,
if that's what you're looking for. The same textual scholars, they'll do a real job on the Bhagavad Gita, so watch out. So here in Dionysius, you see this via negativa taken to its limit. And in here we have, you know, generally the more pious rhetoric of a Christian. But immediately, Trinity, which exceedeth, unfortunately the translator who did this in the 40s had to use archaic English, which exceeds all being, deity and goodness, notice right away, exceeds being. Right? That means it doesn't exist. And right away he starts engaging in this contradictory talk. Dazzling obscurity. Obscurity means darkness. Dazzling means bright. Dazzling obscurity of the secret silence, outshining all brilliance with the intensity of their darkness, and surcharging our blinded intellects with the utterly impalpable and invisible fairness of glories which exceeds all beauty. So right away he indulges in this contradictory language. And he uses, you see down the middle of page 135, beginning of the second paragraph, he uses the term all throughout his treatises, super-essential. Super-essential. So by essence means a particular nature that has a name. So no particular, super-essential. And then right away, that while it possesses all the positive attributes of the universe, being the universal cause, yet in a stricter sense, it does not possess them. So notice that stricter sense. End of the page, 135. That while it possesses all the positive attributes of the universe, because it is the cause of them, in a stricter sense, it does not possess them, since it transcends them all. Wherefore there is no contradicting between affirming and denying that it has them, inasmuch as it precedes and surpasses all deprivation, being beyond all positive and negative distinction. So what he says here, by the way, and here also includes, you notice, I'll come back to this notion of causality here. At the bottom of page 136, again, let me bring your attention to here. And by the way, he starts, when he gets into unity, he changes from he to it. It breaks forth and plunges, I skip a little bit, the true initiate into the darkness of unknowing, wherein he renounces all the apprehensions of his understanding and is enwrapped in that which is wholly intangible and invisible, belonging wholly to him that is beyond all things and to none else. Here he uses a him. And being through the passive stillness of all his reasoning power, united by his highest faculty to him that is wholly unknowable, with a capital U. With a capital U. This is not just ignorance. This is what later on, there's a mystic called Nicholas of Cusa. He used the term, docta ignorata, learned ignorance. Doctor means one who is learned. Like St. Thomas Aquinas is called a doctor of the church. Of course, then they let physicians call themselves doctors and the whole term went downhill, but used to mean a learned person.
Ignorance,
yeah.
Ignorance of the material world?
No, this ignorance means a knowledge that passes reasoning. Unknowing. We already saw that in Plotinus. This notion that it's something that surpasses knowledge. He says, as highest facility to him that is wholly unknowable, of whom, thus, by a rejection of all knowledge, he possesses a knowledge that exceeds his understanding. There's a famous English mystic work dating from, I think, the 15th century called The Cloud of Unknowing. It ain't knowledge, but it ain't ignorance either. It's ignorance with a capital I. Right? So he goes on, you see, from chapter 2, unto this darkness, which is beyond light, we pray that we may come and may attain unto vision through the loss of sight and knowledge. It's there. I'm not making it up. So he goes on, we strip off all qualities in order that we may attain a naked knowledge of that unknowing which is in all existent things, which in all existent things is enwrapped by all objects of knowledge, and that we may begin to see that super essential darkness which is hidden by all the light that is in existent things. So he's indulging in this paradoxical language, you know, for this higher knowledge, which he calls a kind of unknowing or super essential darkness. So here we go, ascending higher. Here we get negative theology via negativity, negativa or neti. Once more, ascending yet higher, we maintain that it is not soul nor mind or endowed with the faculty of imagination, conjecture, reason, or understanding. This is the greatest they're talking about, right? Nor is it any act of reason or understanding, nor can it be described by the reason or perceived by the understanding, since it is not number or order or greatness or littleness or equality or inequality, since it is not immovable, nor is in motion, nor at rest, and has no power. Notice that one. Has no power. Impotent. And is not power or light, and does not live, and is not life, nor is it personal essence, or eternity, or time, nor can it be... And I don't want to go on. This is like blasphemy. This is a great, greatest work of Christian mysticism. Come on. This is it. Everybody, Thomas Aquinas quotes him. Catholic, yeah. Also, you'll see the Protestant mystics. Everybody's into this person, huh?
I don't understand the relationship between Christian mysticism and the Christian church that I grew up with.
Well, there may not be any.
It seems like
there's
a lay group
where it is. Yeah, some ways it's true. In some ways it's true. First of all, they're mystics. There's people who aspire to this vision, you know, who are practicing mystics. And then there are also theologians who aren't necessarily mystics, but who also, influenced by this kind of stuff, say that God, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas says, you know, that we cannot say what God is. St. Thomas Aquinas was not a mystic, at least not until the very last days. But he said, we cannot say what God is, but only what he is not. That's what he said. Well, he believes in God, he accepts the Holy Scriptures and everything, you know. So, but how this actually relates to Christianity is a good question, because my contention I want to make here is that in so many cases, there's a bhakti strand in Christianity, but what you see here is it gets, you know, dominated by the gyan strand over and over again. Yeah?
I always understood that the Christian church that we know is the church of, what do you say in English, Peter? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And that the church from that appeared in
that's a whole nother topic. That's a whole nother topic. Anyway, I want to, let's just finish with Dionysius. So anyway, we see all these negative. You should read that passage if you haven't. It does not belong to the category of non-existence, nor to that of existence. Starts to sound like Buddhists, you know. Nor do extant beings know it as it actually is, nor does it know them as they actually are. Nor can reason attain to it, to name it or to know it. Nor is it darkness, nor is it light or error or truth. And they could say, nor is he both, nor, you know, he could keep on going like that. So that is the unknowing, you know. This via negativa.
Yeah,
it's
describing the nor is it darkness, nor is it light.
Yeah. It was darkness with a capital D. Yes, super essential darkness means it's darkness, but it's something else too. When they put this word super essential, that means what you conceive of as being the essence of darkness is not there. But we can speak of it darkness anyway, because at least all natural light, anyway, light has disappeared from it. It's unknowing. It's not by rational discourse. It's not light, it's not darkness, it's not both light and darkness at the same time, nor is it not light and not, you know, it's the same as the Buddhists. Anyway, this is you know, the via negativa. Now look what happens. Then there comes the big problem, you see, which is your problem, your ordinary Christians. Well, this is God. We say all kinds of pious things about God. He's good, he's this, he's that. You know, all the via positiva, that path of affirmation. How do you reconcile it with this thing up there that's beyond all utterance? So he says that in chapter 1, all the utterances of the sacred writers, the divine names refer in a symbolical revelation to its beneficent emanations. So when we say God is good, God is holy, God is just, God is loving, we're not talking about God. We're talking about that He's the cause of these things. He's the cause of love, the cause of goodness, the cause of just, the cause of knowing. Now, I left in here Stace's critique of this in the very beginning, because he says, he pretty well nails him. He says, if you look at page 133, he says, the essence of Dionysius' theory is that although God is in himself unknowable, so that everything we say of him is, strictly speaking, false, yet we apply terms importing empirical attributes to God because He is the cause of the existence of those empirical characteristics in the world. We say that God exists because He is the cause of all existence. He doesn't, right away, He's beyond existence, right? I'm right here, 133. Right at the bottom. The essence of His theory is that although God is unknowable, so everything we say about Him is false, still we apply terms from this world to Him because He's the cause of the existence of those qualities. So we say that God exists because He's the cause of all existence. We call Him good because He's the cause, the source of all good things, powerful because He's the cause of all powerful, loving because He Himself is not love or loving, because He doesn't know anything besides Himself, really. Yet all love flows from Him as its original source. Then Stace says, I think it is clear that this theory will not do. Apart from the fact that it conceives God as only the source of good things and not of bad things, it also refutes itself, that's what I've been talking about, by applying to God, as He is in Himself, such positive concepts as cause or source. Because you're saying He's the source of these things. But what about this word source or cause? That's also drawn from our experience in this world, isn't it? So you can't say that he's actually the cause, but he has to be the cause or the source of sourceness or the cause of causality. And the whole thing breaks down. It just becomes an infinite regress. You can't apply these terms to him either, because cause and source are also drawn from this world. There's one place where it's not reproduced here, where Dionysius is saying a thing about God. He's saying he's beyond power, he's beyond knowledge, he's beyond truth, he's beyond existence. And then he says he's beyond beyond. And that's exactly what you have. So again, you see, you break the relationship with the world. You make him so unknowable that what is the relationship? So he runs into the same problem. It's there in Plotinus. It comes a little more clearly to the source here with Dionysius. That it looks like Shankara is once again, you know, if he's going to represent the position, the Mayavada position, then God cannot be the cause of the world if he's impersonal. You know, the same thing seems to happen here. That's what seems to be going on. So Stay says like that. All right, can you finish this off? He picked up on it.
If they had a clear description of who God was in their scripture, then I wouldn't be searching for it.
Well, they have a clear description. You can't say that because Shankara has a clear description, but still he manages to negate everything. You have to say that. But it is a fact that in Christian scriptures, one reason that you don't get a clear bhakti trend that overshadows a Mayavad philosophy is that because there is no clear description. I think you're right in that sense.
See, because Jesus, if we understand from his teaching, from what we have, he didn't emphasize a personal God to the extent, well, at least to the extent that.
Well, when we say person, we say what we mean. He has name, form, quality. Prabhupada says, we'll get into this later, the meaning of person. The absolute has senses. Person means that the absolute has senses. But the idea, no, I don't think he was impersonal. But the idea was, senses implies form or body. Since what a body is just a collection of sense organs. Senses grouped about a mind. But, you know, the notion immediately that God has form, very difficult, at least for the Jews of Jesus' time to accept, because immediately they think of material form. Although in the Bible, Old Testament, God is represented over and over again as in a human form. By the get to Jesus' time, everybody's saying, well, this is just symbolic. Partially, you know, they were into the Greeks. See, the Greeks were already there with this idea of abstraction. You know, the truth lies in abstraction. The further away you get from concrete and into the abstract, the closer you get to the truth and to the spiritual. You know, so the idea that something spiritual had concrete form wouldn't go. And people, the idea of you have to be very advanced to have the idea of a spiritual form. Although that idea is in the Bible. It's applied to human beings. St. Paul says that when we are resurrected, we go to the kingdom of God, we have pneumatikon soma. I don't know if I can remember how to spell that. But it's there. And this is, you know, I've used this with Christians before. Soma is body. Pneumatikon, I think it's K-O-N, K-A-N, pneumatikon. Pneuma is spiritual. Pneumatikon soma, spiritual body. So that's the Christian doctrine of resurrection. But what's resurrected is not your material body, as less educated Christians think, like the Jehovah Witnesses. But pneumatikon soma, a spiritual body, glorified body. Have you heard that? A glorified body. A spiritual body. Got to be an American to hear that one. The pneumatikan soma. So if in the kingdom of God we have a spiritual body, what about God? Why not God? But they don't know what it is. There's no description. Moses on Mount Sinai said he only saw God's backside. Backside means rear end. It does. It's right there in the Bible. He didn't see his face, but he saw God going away. He saw his backside. Make of it what you want. But it talks about, you know, God was there and he had a face and he had a backside. All is mentioned there.
How would he know that was God?
He wouldn't, would you? The Gnostics say, you know, that's actually the Demiurge. Anyway, he said he's God. He asked him who he was. And he answered, "I am who I am." Which is where the name Yahweh comes from. And he handed him the tablets. And there was a lot of thunder and lightning and, you know, it was a pretty impressive display. So whoever he was, either God directly or somebody who was, you know, empowered representative, let's say. And handed him the tablets. So anyway, that's... So the idea is there that God has a form. So, but in Christian theology, because there's no descriptions given, what is that form? I remember seeing a newspaper column written by Billy Graham. Somebody wrote him and said, "What will we do when we get to heaven?" And he answered, he said, "I don't know." He said, "I'm sure that we're not idle there, and there must be some heavenly wonderful task." He says, "But I don't know what it is." You see, so because of a dearth of information about the personal nature of God, therefore these impersonal, mystical kind of things tend to oversway or overrule. And when we get to St. John of the Cross, we'll see that although it's personalistic, and although he makes him very firm about we don't become God, still, the same structure of the experience is the same structure as the impersonal experience. And it involves getting rid of images, ideas, anything concrete in the mind. So we can see that too. If you look at Meister Eckhart, oh, we don't have time. Yeah. He means those that have this experience of undifferentiated unity.
Is there some kind of vision or a change that
intelligence? Well, whatever Plotinus and Dionysius are describing, that's what it is.
Said that
McShirley McLean, I don't know what she sees or what she has.
It just seems to me like
out of body experiences. Well, these aren't out of body experiences. I mean, these aren't things that you see, or these aren't far out experiences. This is a sense of merging into an ultimate undifferentiated oneness. We would ascribe it to something like the experience of the impersonal Brahman or some Vairaja river, something up there. That's one. Because I don't doubt that some of these people have real experiences. At least for a time, they experience the loss of their identity and some emergence of their self into an ineffable unity, and so on. I'll take them at their word. But as I said to us, I gave you that little figure the last time. You know, and they represent over and over again the structure of this experience is represented as a kind of a cone or a spiral that comes to a peak, you know, of unification. And I said, there's another side which they don't see. You know, this is the tree with its roots upward and its branches downward, which is the figure used to describe the material world. That's the reflection of something else. They only get this far. They only get this far. But Krishna consciousness, you know, comes from here. We don't have their experiences because we're not even after their experiences. Yeah.
When you say that one of the strengths of the Mayavadis is that so many different Mayavadis from different times and places all came up with very similar ideas.
Yeah.
So can we defeat that by saying the reason that they all come up with that is that's the basic like Mumu pathology of the self?
Yeah, sure. Sure. Of course they come up with it. Anytime anybody sits in the material world and tries to speculate or raise themselves to the absolute, they're going to bang their head against this oneness, and they're going to get sucked in, and they come in and they get whirled around and they shoot back out down again. Very rarely do you go back and you go up. It's like this vortex, this black hole, and there's this singularity, you know, and you come up and you pew, and you shoot back down again. Uh-huh, right. I suspect, you know, if you actually maintain it, you know, you don't write books. You're just in samadhi, you know, until your body dies. You know, if there are those that have attained it as a permanent state, we don't know anything about them. They don't come back to say anything. Yeah, right. They're gone. It's like near-death experiences, you know. You can't really... They didn't die. They came close, maybe. It's time to go. We have to stop. Prahlad's walking in. No, he's gone by.